Welcome back to RareMind Talks, the show where we explore how data, technology, and human-centered innovation are reshaping the world of rare diseases. Today, I'm joined by Richard Novak, CEO of Unravel, a pioneering company using advanced computational modeling and RNA analysis to rethink how we understand and treat rare diseases. Instead of focusing only on your DNA, Unravel looks at RNA, which tells us what your body is actively doing right now. But we'll learn more about it. Richard, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I must tell, it's the first one we are recording live. So very excited.
I'm honored.
So let's start simple. Let's look at the human side of what you do. How would you explain what Unravel does to a parent whose child has a rare disease?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, it's not even limited to that. If you have any disease, and every disease is really complex. There may be the definition of a disease, but that doesn't capture what a patient is going through or the family around that patient. And so then the question becomes, how do you fix it? Whatever fix means for that family, right? Everybody has different definitions of what health looks like. And there's some that people can agree on, others not so much. And so to everyone, it's a little bit different. And every patient starts at a different spot. And the whole idea was that rather than running away from it, which is what the typical pharma approach is, how do we make a model, a single model of the disease? How do we standardize things? The idea is, well, life is messy, diseases are messy, patients are messy. And let's find out all the problems and complexity as soon as possible. Not once you have a drug after 10 years, $1 billion, and then you go into the clinic and it fails. I would rather have those problems ironed out earlier. And that's better for patients because then they can get the treatment they need faster and be more effective.
Absolutely. And you've focused on RNA, as I was mentioning, instead of DNA, which we heard more often. So for those who don't speak science, what does RNA tell us? And why is it so useful for understanding a patient's condition in real time?
Yeah, no, so let me define DNA and RNA for the audience that may not be familiar with it. So DNA is probably what most people are familiar with from Jurassic Park, getting DNA from mosquitoes, engineering dinosaurs. That's really thought to be the blueprint of life or the cells, right? It doesn't change. The only time it really changes is in cancer cells, where you get mutations and it causes all these problems. But for most patients, for most of these rare disease patients, it doesn't change. It's actually very stable. The problem is the disease.
It's the real identity card of a person.
It is. So forensics uses that. So, you know, it's like a fingerprint, but molecular. So yes, FBI uses that, and all the crime shows, of course, they use DNA. That is DNA, right? And because it doesn't change, it's very specific to each person. The problem is it doesn't change. And these diseases do change. People change with age, with treatment. You know, what you ate for breakfast changed you a little bit, right? If you didn't eat breakfast, you would feel different. Your DNA hasn't changed, but what about it is making you feel different? Well, the DNA gives rise to RNA, and it's called messenger RNA. It sends the message from the blueprint to the cells to make these proteins, do this, do that, right? And some RNA controls other RNA, can get very complex, but essentially it regulates, it controls what the cell is doing. So that's the RNA. And then they can give rise to proteins. And proteins are usually the enzymes, the building blocks of the cells. This is why, you know, you can feel something like tissue, all that. That's mostly protein. And then there are things like metabolites, other small molecules that make all that whole process work. And so the difference is that DNA is static, which can make it very good for analyzing, identifying people, and then analyzing these mutations. Because these mutations in these patients with rare diseases, they also don't change.
Yeah.
So if you want to diagnose a patient, it's actually a very good path. And that's the most common path. So all these rare disease families who have had a diagnosis, or even if they haven't, they've probably had a genetic test done. And that's been on DNA, almost certainly, or something like whole exome sequencing, but it's still focusing more on the DNA type of the mutations. What we do is very different. It's looking at, okay, I want the changes. How does a person change over the course of a day? And especially, how can we change that person's state without having to define it? But how can we change that with medication? And that has to be dynamic.
Yeah.
It's not static. That's all we want, right? And so that's why we look at the RNA. So kind of that messenger that regulates things. So essentially the instructions being sent back and forth. Because it tells us about what's going on. It can change on a minute basis, minutes to hours, not even days.
So that's pretty much real-time data.
Exactly. Here's a great example. So we like to say that, you know, with what we do is sort of like Google Maps, right?
Yeah.
The DNA is a paper plan of the city. Here are where the streets go, here's that, here's buildings, here's all that, right? Well, but if you're driving through the city, that map can be very helpful, right? Absolutely. But the reality is you might have a traffic jam. This street might have construction on it and might be closed. There, you know, this street that normally is closed now opened up. All these changes, and that's what you get, for example, with real-time traffic information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
That's more of the RNA level. It doesn't change how you go, but it doesn't change where you go, but it changes how you go. And maybe going farther may be a faster way to go from point A to point B.
In knowing that, I believe it will then accelerate some discovery and some research.
Right. Well, so we ask a different question. So the other term that families might be familiar with is like bioinformatics, right? So really, how do we analyze this data from patients? And historically, it's focused on what's different.
Mm-hmm.
And what's different at the DNA level, that's tied to diagnosis. What's different at the RNA level could be used for diagnosis, but more often than not, it's looking at, well, which proteins are being made, which genes are being controlled in this way or that. The problem is, what's different doesn't mean it's bad.
Right.
Some things are good because the body there's a problem and it's trying to fix it. And let's say there's a lot of inflammation. Well, it may be fixing it with some other mechanisms because we evolved to survive. And so what's different isn't necessarily good or bad, or it could be neutral. It could be it could be something you ate this morning. It could be different.
But at least you have that dynamic information that you can work
with. And now you can start analyzing it. Yeah. But we ask a different question, which is, how do you fix an abnormal state?
Mm-hmm.
Not what's different. Because again, different could be good, bad, or neutral.
Right.
But let's simulate, if we make a small change, does that make the patient a little bit better, a little bit worse, or it's not relevant, right? And so with really the high-powered computation and AI, we can start making sense of the differences and actually providing function and meaning to them. And now it's sort of like that traffic map,
which is,
okay, there's a traffic jam here, but you know, maybe I actually don't need to go through that neighborhood at all. So that doesn't affect me. But maybe this other traffic jam does, and there's another traffic jam here. Oh, but now, okay, I have to go all the way here. All I care about is not so much what's different, but how do I go from where I am now in a disease state to a healthier state?
In talking about platforms, your platform, BioNav, found subgroups even within patients with ZTTK syndrome, which is a clinical trial that you are running. Why is that important? And how could it change how we treat rare diseases? So how do you leverage your platform?
Right. So again, there's been this assumption that you can treat the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So all these drugs are approved for treating a certain disorder or disease or some other state. The reality is that if you ask clinicians and patients, you know, does every patient with the same diagnosis respond to a given molecule, a given drug that's approved, let's say, for that disease? The answer is absolutely not.
Yeah.
You know, you have to try it, and some patients do, maybe overall, because that's what the clinical trial showed. But I don't know of any trials where 100% of the patients actually had a positive response or a full response. It may have been a partial response or even adverse effects. It caused other problems, right? And so there oftentimes patients have to get off of a molecule because of it's either not helping or because it's causing even more problems. That's the reality. And so what we're doing is saying, let's work with that reality and let's find drugs that either could work for everyone, but more likely it's going to work on a subset of patients. And let's define a group A and a group B or however many. Based on the data, right? And that's based on the RNA. And now we can simulate, what if we give someone aspirin? What would happen? And we can go through and try one molecule at a time for any number of molecules, and in a very safe way, because it's computational. And we can predict, okay, who would respond to what? And that's with existing molecules. And then we can do that with new molecules, right? So even molecules that haven't been in patients, we can simulate their activity. And so what it does for biological discovery and drug discovery is, let's build drugs for patients who respond, as opposed to let's build drugs for a disease.
Oh, okay.
All right. So let's treat the patient, not the disease. And this goes back to you know, the early days of medicine in the 1800s. A great physician treats the patient. That's treat the patient. And it goes back to that complexity of every patient's unique. And let's find some common patterns, but they may not be tied to a diagnosis. And so what we're doing is going beyond the diagnosis and seeing how do we fix the problem by defining it from a molecular state as opposed to maybe the most obvious symptom, you know, a seizure disorder or something like that.
And Unravel works a lot on the rare diseases space. And as a patient advocate of rare diseases, it's very interesting to also see that the rare diseases here can be or can act like a launch pad for innovation as well. What makes them such a strong starting point, them as in rare diseases? What makes such a strong starting point for building the next generation health solutions?
Yeah, it's actually has very little to do with the science. It's the families. It's the patient advocates, the caregivers, and the patients themselves. Sometimes the patients can't speak for themselves, but it's that set of stakeholders that are, you know, intimately tied to the patient that enable this. Because they unfortunately have not benefited from as many of the biotechnological advances historically. They're very motivated. And now in the last, I'd say 10 years, they've gotten very, very advanced in terms of their thinking and strategy. And so I think we're at a really fantastic time where all the tools and the resources are in place, the education place, even some of the financial models are changing around empowering these rare disease groups to really, you know, treat their own patients and finding treatments for them. And that's so different from a non-rare disease, like one of these more common ones where, you know, there may be some associations, but they're not as targeted around therapies because there are these big companies, multi-billion dollar companies throwing money at these problems. And it's a very different environment and different timelines, different scales of doing drug development. And I think that's the biggest change. And that's what attracted us. We actually didn't set out to start in rare disease exclusively, but we found that it's actually partners like yourselves that are really make or break the projects. It's not the science. The science can be done on any disease equally. But having that engagement and the guidance of like, what are we fixing the right problem? Are we focusing on the right problem? That input is so critical. And that's that team is what succeeds.
So we've talked about the rare diseases, the innovation, the platform, and we need to talk about AI. And it's a very hyped term at these days. So where do you see the real value from AI on what you do? And where do we still need to be a bit cautious of what it can do?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a gradient. I mean, since the concept of AI has been here since the 1950s, at least, ever since computers were like, well, how far can we push them? That was the question, right? So from the earliest days of computing, the difference now is really that we can do so much. The power is really astonishing, right? I mean, I think they said that the computational power of all the computers on the Apollo rocket that went to the moon, I think a typical calculator can outcompete that now, right? So that's how much things have changed. And so with, I think the real change happened with you know, what most people call AI now, as just within the last few years, it's really these large language models. So, you know, OpenAI's ChatGPT and all these other flavors that came out of that, because it lets non-technical experts communicate with the computer. It's really that language piece, the LLM and a large language model. It's the language part that's really key. You don't need somebody to program it or train a, you know, use Python to train on a massive data set. You can just talk to it. The problem becomes that it seems smart, but it's very convincing. And I think it plays to our narcissism a little bit, where the responses flatter us. Where people really like that, and so it does some really amazing things, like some of the image generators and image alterators, really impressive, right? And especially just the changes of going from someone with 8 fingers to now having 5 fingers on a hand, really, you know, really nice improvements. But I see it more as a really good search engine, where it can take all these disparate sources of data and integrate them and give you sort of a more coherent answer, as opposed to coming up with entirely new concepts. And so a lot of this depends on the data that you feed it. And we're actually getting into a point where if you keep training the systems on data that now increasingly include AI generated data, it's a self-serving problem where now you're training on itself. And there have been some interesting simulations that artificially accelerate that, and you end up with junk, complete junk over time if you keep pushing it. And so the danger is that without new data, it doesn't necessarily tell you anything new. And so, for example, if you have this, you know, I always say there's a bucket of knowledge, and it can search through that bucket and pull out pieces that maybe weren't previously connected, but they're already generated pieces of knowledge. What it doesn't do is look outside that bucket. And that's where new data, new concepts are going to be generated. And so that's really what we do, because we don't use the large language models, but we use RNA from cell lines, from patients, from drug treatments, just telling us, well, what is changing? Mm-hmm. I don't have an assumption about what should or shouldn't change or anything, but we can use that to now ask, okay, how is the system changing? And so we can add to that bucket of knowledge and then analyze it. And so, you know, that's the one part that's changed. It's more that language piece that's changed, but like deep neural nets, those are not fundamentally that different from OpenAI's approach, except for the language piece, I think is the biggest, really big differentiator. Mm-hmm.
And you've mentioned data. So rare diseases, obviously it's not known to have many gigabytes of data, right? So how do you leverage that to advance your research, having smaller buckets of data?
Yeah, so a couple different ways. So this is where we decided to focus on RNA, because one, it was dynamic, as we discussed, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. The other part, if there is a data set, it will like that it is dynamic. So basically RNA, protein, or metabolites, mm-hmm. There's way more RNA being generated.
Okay.
Because it comes off the same machines, usually Illumina or some other platform, as the DNA, right? And so it was able to piggyback historically off all the technological advances. Proteomic is really gaining a lot of traction now because the instruments have dramatically improved. Even like year to year, there's some really nice improvements. But all these public databases, are there data sets for some rare diseases, for any diseases? Well, for proteomics, it's just less in general for any disease, right? Whereas there's a lot more for RNA. So that was one piece. Let's focus on a modality that there's just more data likely to be available. So that's one. Two is we have to generate data mm-hmm. from the patients. And so, you know, there are a couple approaches. Historically, it's been, there's a center of excellence at a typically, you know, large academic center. Patients come there, they do blood draws, poke and prod, do whatever, collect tissues, and it's still done. And there's a lot of value there, but you're going to inherently leave out patients who can't do that, right? If they, especially the more severe ones who can't travel, or just, you know, if you're in a remote, like a different country or a remote part of a given country, it may not be financially or somehow logistically feasible to go there. So what do? Well, we found that with our network analysis, with the RNA, we can use essentially any tissue to collect that RNA. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we used what's been very popular since 2020, which is nasal swabs from COVID, with a very good preservation solution, so you don't need to refrigerate or freeze, and we can ship these kits all around the world. And so people do a nasal swab, put it in a tube, and then ship it back through the mail. And now we've been able to work literally every continent. No penguins in Antarctica yet, but all around the world, and even out back of Australia, remote parts of Africa, Latin America, I mean, like, and even very rural parts of the United States, which can be, you know, hours to the nearest mailbox. We've been able to access patients where they are. So we go to where the patients are, as opposed to having the patients come to us.
And that addresses a really important problem, not just in the rare disease, but in healthcare, which is the bias of the data in
Absolutely.
Clinical trials, right? As you said, I mean, it's many years ago, maybe it was only people living next to the places where the clinical trials were running.
Right.
Today, you're doing a global clinical trial for a set of diseases with a set of patients, but collecting different sets of data that can give you much more insights than before.
Right, exactly. So we go to where the patients are, and some rare diseases are spread all around the world mm-hmm. uniformly. Others have geographic hotspots. And so what might be ultra, ultra rare in the United States might be actually fairly common, might not even be a rare disease in some certain geographic areas, right? We work on one rare disease in the Philippines, or originated in the Philippines. There are 10 known patients in the entire United States.
All right.
On some of these islands, it might be 1 in 1,000.
Oh.
So it's not even rare by general standards, right? On these couple islands where the disease originated, right? Because it was a founder mutation. So if you were related to someone, you're at risk. And so then where do you do the trial? Not in the United States.
Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't make any sense, right? You would do it in those areas. And then you have to figure out how do you go there. And then what we're looking at is how do we change some of these sampling methods and metrics? How do you know if it's working? That's not always easy. So then we have to close the loop where the patients are. And so, for example, we're going to be running two clinical trials in Colombia and South America, in Medellin, because there are patients there. And there are no other clinical trials. They're, you know, really eager for us to go there and set up these trials. It's not, it makes things faster, cheaper, better for everyone. It's not skipping on, you know, standards of science or regulatory safety standards. It's really going to where the patients are, and we're getting pulled in those directions, and that's what we're open to.
And solving the real problems where they are.
We work, my background, you know, partly was in product design. And you work with the potential customers to design the product. You don't just make something that you think would work and then sell it, right? That almost never works. You want that feedback loop, and that's what we're doing. And the other part is that we're doing this with existing molecules first, right? Why build something new if you could see if it's going to work with something readily available? It's been tested. The safety is characterized. It may not be completely safe, but you know how to assess the risk, how to measure it, how to reduce the risk. And you can try something. And you can try something today. Not in 10 years. That's the other difference.
You're talking about the product design and
Yes.
where it fails. In a space where 98% of new drug targets fail, how do you make smart and strategic decisions at Unravel? And especially when you know, as you're saying, that the patients are waiting for a solution.
Yeah, so they fail. That statistic, it's a really interesting one. So yeah, on average, 98% of drugs that enter the clinic. So already all the preclinical parts, all the failures have already happened. So of the ones that have passed that, you have great preclinical data. 98% of those programs will fail in the clinic. Mostly about 70% of those because it just doesn't work. It's not that it's toxic, it's, you know, it just doesn't work. So the hypothesis that this target will help this disease in some way was wrong. Or wasn't validated, it wasn't supported. So that's the complexity of biology. Fine. So what we do is it's like rapid prototyping for product design. You might 3D print a mock-up, but you want to test a function or so get some feedback from the potential customer. And so you 3D print. You don't start making massive manufacturing lines, spend millions of dollars when you don't know if this is what you want to make at all, right? But spending, you know, a few dollars on a cheap 3D printed mock-up that shows some function or shape or, you know, customer can interact with it and give you feedback, that's incredibly valuable because you can do that probably in a day for a few dollars, right? And so that's why we're using existing drugs because, you know, we don't know if it's going to work, but how can we test it? And so it's, again, starting with the patients and working backwards. I don't care what the target is. I care that it works. And you want to know why? As the CEO of a company, I want drugs that will help patients because that will make money. A drug that doesn't help patients will not make money. And it's a win-win because patients want drugs that work, not something that's just expensive. And so that's the idea, that we're making this a win-win, being pulled by the patients, and then working with them iteratively in their clinicians and all the people who know the disease far better than we ever will. But we can enable that kind of design, build, test cycle that you get in product design and every other discipline, really, right? Architecture. You know, bridges, you know, they don't just build a bridge. They simulate it, they test it, they make mock-ups, they do all these things. Cars, I mean, everything goes through this very intricate process, except for healthcare. Starts with a target. Let's see if it works in the clinic. No, okay, we spent 10 years doing that. Didn't work.
That's it the other way
Great,
around.
that company's done. So the idea was there has to be a better way because, you know, you're spending $1 billion and it probably will fail. So that was the idea.
As a CEO as well, how do you keep your team motivated, knowing, you know, these failure rates that we spoke about, and you know, obviously the breakthrough can come in, but how do you motivate your teams?
Again, the patients. That's why we're here. If you don't want to fix a patient problem, you're in the wrong business. You should be fixing something else then. Or, you know, don't work with patients, work with, you know, other types of customers. That's why we do it. And we select for a team that appreciates that. And not everybody will, that's not what motivates everyone. But then my point is, well, maybe this isn't for you. And so we've had built a fantastic team that really, this is what moves and drives everyone. And then we go to conferences like the one today, which we have two other people coming from Unravel to interact with. Sure, the scientists, the companies, all that is part of it, but especially the parents and the patients. Usually, it's parents and their kids, and that's really why we do it. And then we also work with clinicians, and we hear stories about what works, what doesn't work, and then seeing some of these successes where some of these off-label uses of drugs have had, you know, meaningful quality of life improvements. That, I mean, that motivates everyone, and especially if you're like an intern You do this computation, and then your results lead to a clinician deciding to prescribe a drug for a patient, and it works. So in a couple months, like 3 months, you went from starting a project to seeing somebody, like in one case, start walking after a year and a half, not walk, right? And so it can be like that's powerful. So you can feel really connected to the end goal, and everybody plays a very different role, and they get that. But it's about that overall motivation of like, what problem are we solving? And that's the North Star. Everything else is secondary.
That there's a purpose on your journey there.
Exactly.
And looking forward, let's look a little bit into the future. How do you help patients, doctors, and the healthcare systems understand and trust tools like Unravel?
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, the key word is trust, right? You need validation, you need data, but you can generate data, and you don't know ultimately until a patient is treated,
How do you
right?
educate them?
Yeah, and my point is that, right, that you don't, there's a lot of unknowns, and you need some trust to try something before it's been validated fully, because if it's already been validated, then you don't need to build trust again, or on that context, because it's already done. So that's hard. I mean, one thing, in terms of our mission, vision, and values, it's really having a very open, data-driven process. And we share everything with everyone we work with, all our partners. We don't hide any data, good or bad, or that we've recently caught a bug in our code that they changed some results. Look, that's what happens. That's science. I mean, if you're not innovating, if you're not making mistakes, you're not innovating.
Exactly.
But the idea is that, we share that, we're very transparent. We look for partners who appreciate that. If you just want a clean, perfect product, then probably won't happen in the biotech space. But
And that's an interrupt, Richard, because I think that is a very important mindset that I see in Portugal. We need to adopt a lot more, which is, and Nelson Mandela used to say that, I never fail. I either win or learn, but we need to fail in order to improve and go into the next step. And I do think that, especially in the rare disease spaces, I don't see that a lot. And I would like to see a lot more in Portugal and even at European level. I would like to see that mindset a little bit more there as
Yeah,
well.
I mean, ultimately, what I love about science is, you can only fake it for so long. At some point, there's data that will prove you right or wrong.
Indeed.
And it's okay if you're wrong, but you haven't solved the problem. And so, as long as it's about let's fix the problem, you might need multiple tries. You almost certainly need multiple tries. Like, I don't know of many programs. Certainly in my own experience with I don't know how many dozens of different programs even before Unravel, that something worked right the first time. And that's okay. The idea is okay, well, but let's figure it out. Let's make it work.
Exactly.
And then let's, if there are bugs or incorrect assumptions, more data lets you correct your assumptions and then get better. And so I love that either you win or you learn something. And learning is a great outcome. The problem is if you get something, if you don't succeed and you don't learn, and that's what happens all too often, is like, oh, that didn't work. Let's not tell anyone about it. It's not healthy. And that breaks trust. But it also doesn't actually advance your goal, because what might be seen as a failure initially may not actually be a failure. It may just be new data telling you something that you
Indeed,
didn't know
indeed.
before.
And we are talking about drug repurposing, which is a good example of that as well,
We
right?
might not
Something
have
that
known that aspirin
exactly.
has these other uses, right?
Exactly.
And I keep picking on aspirin, but
There
mostly
are other
because it actually
examples.
hasn't been all that successful in other applications.
But Richard, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today and to share all that those insights and wisdom to our audience as well. It's absolutely fascinating to see what's happening behind the scenes of drug repurposing, of BioNeVo, of Unravel, of course. Thank you very much for sharing that. And it's also clear that with the right data, the right models, and most importantly, the right mindset, as we are just talking about, we can start designing treatments around the patient and not for the diseases, as you've mentioned very clearly as well. Thank you very much for being here with me today. And for those listening, if you are a patient, parent, if you are a researcher, clinician, or policymaker, I hope today's conversation gave you a better understanding of what RNA-based medicine could mean for the future of rare disease care. As always, thanks for pausing with us to think deeply about what matters. Until next time on Rare Mind Talks, stay curious and keep exploring.